Welcome everyone to Film Strips, the podcast guaranteed to tick off both the art house and mainstream crowds. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Carnegie, sir.
Actually, I guess the question is, can we have an art house crowd for our podcast? I'm not really sure whether our show qualifies as art, but...
Well, I think we need more musical interludes, random, like, audio cuts to just, like, a person narrating their diary with wind noise underneath it. I don't know. We'll just make sure that all the show notes say directed by Gus Van Sant at the end. I don't know why Gus Van Sant is the first director I thought of when I think art house cinema, which is probably a sign I could use another cup of coffee.
Well, the key thing is, can we get Philip Glass to come in and do the score for our podcast? Because that'll be our bridge, the one that sort of unites the art house and mainstream crowds, like happened on Candyman 2.
That's true. But Dave, if we take away the bumper music, then I truly have nothing left to contribute.
All right, Philip Glass, take a backseat.
You wouldn't do that to your old pal Andy, would you? Look at you, now, Mr. Babbitt.
I think I can avoid doing that, especially okay. Since I don't think we can afford Philip Glass.
And in return, I'll avoid doing that voice ever again. But speaking of silly voices and bridging divides between registers of cinema, what are we talking about this week, Dave?
Okay, so last week we took a look at a little film called Shakes the Clown, one of the most riveting films we've ever covered on the show, and one of the most riveting conversations we've ever had. Don't go looking back into that, because trust me, just take us at our word there. But
we should do this every episode.
Yes, but one of the people in that little film is Adam Sandler. And we decided, rather than follow him to, say, one of his notable comedic highlights such as Happy Gilmore or Billy Madison or Little Nicky. I'm sorry, I can't even let
don't forget Grown Ups.
Seriously.
And Grown Ups 2, Grown Harder.
Is it too late just to walk away? No, instead we decided to take a look at probably the biggest oddity in his career, and that is the 2002 film Punch Drunk Love, a P.T. Anderson movie that at first, if you're sitting there thinking, well, of course Paul Anderson and Adam Sandler would work together, neither one's respected. No, no, this is the good Paul Anderson. Paul T. Anderson, not Paul W.S.
Paul T. Anderson, yeah. Exactly. The Magnolia, not Resident Evil Part 9 or whatever they're at.
Yeah, and I my apologies to Paul W.S. Anderson. By all accounts, you're a really nice guy, but...
Yeah, plus you film in Toronto. If you ever want to show up on our show and we'll pretend to like your movies, slide on into our DMs.
Yeah, but...
But yeah, so at this point in time, though, Paul Thomas Anderson... Even now, I feel like he is not thrown out there. Like, his name doesn't mean quite the same thing as a Spielberg or a Hitchcock. But definitely by 2018, there's something distinct that saying Paul Thomas Anderson directed this movie means. And in 2002, though, we're starting to get a sense of what that is as well. Because previously, he had directed the sort of neo-noir Hard Eight, and then really, really broke through in terms of popular attention with Boogie Nights, a film that, you know, both glamorizes and shows the seedy underbelly of the L.A. porn scene. And then Magnolia, which stars every actor you can possibly think of and is one of the few VHSs I ever owned that forced that had two different cassettes in the box. So... But that being said, regardless of what the Paul Thomas Anderson style was shaping out to be by the time this film comes out, I think it's safe to say that Punch Drunk Love is very different from what that expectation is.
Well, that's the thing. And Paul Thomas Anderson, yeah, was certainly one of those individuals who, you know, I think at that point could have pretty much written his ticket to anything in terms of either Oscar films or, you know, art house, you know, indie cinema. And instead, he ends up writing and directing a film around a star he happened to apparently like quite a bit. And that is Adam Sandler. Now, I don't think... I would say Adam Sandler's kind of self-explanatory if you've paid attention to cinema for, say, the last 25 years. But I think we probably, it's best to place him in his context, Andrew. Would you agree with that?
Well, I mean, I guess the benefit is because he's played the same character his entire career. Contextualizing won't take long. But yes, like a lot of high-profile 90s comedians that segued into film, Sandler got his start working on Saturday Night Live, established his tendency to speak in silly voices, and then eventually crossed into film. First, with smaller movies like Shakes the Clown, but by the time Billy Madison comes out, that really kind of sets the blueprint. That's his first big movie, and that's when America falls in love with a guy who vacillates between acting like a child and getting incredibly angry at his famous neighbors and punching them out.
Exactly. And I'm sure, yeah, most people are probably familiar with what I think are generally held up as being the two really good Sandler films, Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore. That doesn't mean they were critically well-received movies. In fact, I'm not entirely sure that anything Adam Sandler has done where he has had a hand in writing or producing the film has ever been critically well received.
No, there's a reason people still, you know, there's a certain section of the world where if you say, yeah, and Grizzly Adams had a beard, they know exactly what to follow up with. But I will maintain, though, Mr. Deeds is underrated. It's not as good as they think it is, but it's better than you would assume. None of which is going to be discussed here. But yeah, so, yeah. I mean, in previous episodes, though, we've talked about the challenge of playing against type, and the weird thing that came out when we were discussing just prior is that this is a film where Adam Sandler, he's not playing against type in the sense of character. Like, Barry, the character he plays in Punch Drunk Love, firmly fits within that Sandler pantheon, but it's different because there's a very different emphasis. Like, the film isn't built around playing his explosivity as a gag, or, like, his inwardness as a sign of endearment. Instead, like, this is basically the film that takes every Adam Sandler character he portrayed on screen, and then is willing to diagnose everything problematic, disturbing, and toxic about it.
Yeah, and I guess the number one we should probably note right off the bat for anybody who may be tuning in for the first time, we spoil the heck out of films on the show because these are conversations and analysis of the movies we discuss. So if you want to check out now and watch this film unspoiled, now is the time to do it. If you have seen the film already before or don't really care about spoilers, come join us.
Pull up a seat. We'll be here a while.
Yeah, absolutely, as the running time on our average episodes very much indicate. But, yes, yeah, so, yeah, I'm trying to think of a good analogy to sort of express what this film is like, and the best thing I can think of is, for those, you know, who are probably familiar with long-running sort of series of novels in that, like the James Bond novels, let's take by Ian Fleming, every so often, I mean, we've had authors who've come in, some of them famous, some of them not. And what you notice is they try and that when they're invited to write in a particular, for a particular series like this, they try and adapt themselves to a degree to the template set by their predecessor in this instance. So when you have someone coming in to do a James Bond novel, you know, sometimes they try, I mean, will be trying to imitate Ian Fleming's style to a degree.
Well, yeah, there's a mold, and within the mold, especially in franchises, but even elsewhere, once you build up enough of a sense of what a genre is supposed to look like, sound like, play out like, and when you have certain actors that become very associated with particular mannerisms or characterizations or types of films, that is a convention that Anytime you're trying to create, you run into conflict with that.
Yeah, and in the case of, you know, Punch Drunk Love, this really does feel like Paul Thomas Anderson set a challenge out to himself, which is write a film that is basically within the mold of Adam Sandler's work. And, you know, see if he can, you know, do so while injecting himself into it. So the end result, plot-wise, is a film that, you know, in the broad strokes, isn't necessarily outside of your typical Adam Sandler fare. It is about, you know, in this instance, Barry Egan, a, you know, sort of low-key individual who runs his own little company making plungers to sell around the world, who ends up, you know, coming in contact with one woman who seems to be that of his dreams. And, you know, the whole film revolves around him trying to get to her. But there are some, what we would consider maybe mechanical complications in the form of something that sets out to disrupt his attempts at romance.
And I mean, that is a pretty typical setup. You go to the movies now, you watch any rom-com, that's familiar. Man loves woman, or woman loves man, or people love people, 2018 and all that, then there's a threat. Either, you know, there's a secret that must be kept, or there's a romantic rival or something. We still get that same mechanic here, but filtered through Paul Thomas Anderson's style. It's not that he has to compete for the affection of Lena, played by Emily Watson. Barry's not competing against other suitors. Instead, the problematic here is that he is being blackmailed by a phone sex line.
Yeah, and this is sort of where one of the things I think it's interesting to get into with this movie is, and I think probably, you know, points us in the direction of many of the questions we end up being faced with, what is, you know, I think many people on the surface would describe this as a romantic comedy or a romantic comedy drama. Because certainly, as we sort of acknowledge so far, but this is a film that skews more towards the dramatic, and while there's plenty of humor throughout, it's not of the type that we typically see, again, in Adam Sandler's mainstream comedy, where everything is sort of takes place in a cartoonish reality. And the idea of, I'm going to, you know, try and get through all of grade school to high school and get my diploma in 12 weeks, and watching Adam Sandler fit in with children, you know, that's not the kind of world this is in. This is something closer to reality, but
though this movie would be so much better if Darren McGavin showed up as his dad.
Actually, yeah, that would be amazing. But yeah, no, the thing about this thing is I'm not really sure whether calling this a romantic comedy is appropriate.
And I think that's the biggest sticking point that we've had. Just like, how do we frame this film? And believe me, dear listeners, we've tried working through like several different ways of just explaining what this film is and how it's positioned. And none of them seem totally satisfying because, you know, if you call it a rom-com, well, it's humorous, but the humor, I feel like it's not based on gags or wordplay. It's based on absurdity and like sort of discomfort more than anything. Even as a romantic film, like love is very much the operative theme here, but I mean, like, we pretty much follow Barry more or less exclusively, and Lena sort of shows up not peripheral to the narrative, but there's definitely less focus and less characterization. It's not building their relationship as a true mutuality. But if it's just a character study of a lonely man, well, we're also denied that interiority into Barry. But if it's meant to be like a fluffy, like, love letter to the movies, it's way too dark for that. But if it's also meant to be like an exploration of human misery, it's also way too sweet and uplifting in parts for that to really seem sufficient. So I think the best way I can think of it is like, it feels like an exercise in style about the idea of love more than love as an actual thing generated by people.
To a degree, I agree, but that's the thing is, part of me wants to say that what Paul Thomas Anderson is a smart filmmaker. Let's get this right out of the way. I think he's too smart to make a film and not know what he's trying to do in some way, shape, or form.
I'll agree with you there. I mean, anyone who's, it's actually a treat to listen to any interview with P.T. Anderson. He does come off as very self-aware, very knowledgeable, and he also just has a manner of speaking where even if what he's saying isn't true, you want to believe it.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, as I'm looking at this movie, to me, I'm not even entirely sure it's a film about love. so much as it is a film about loneliness and disconnection and the way in which our culture sort of frames the idea of relationships and what it means to be in one and how we sort of internalize that in not exactly healthy ways.
Soundtrack by John Bryan.
I think it's interesting because I think this is an instance where I think we're both sort of approaching this film from the opposite directions, but the film is such enough of a muddled, not muddled, but I think that's part of the problem is to say it's muddled would be to suggest that the affect that this film has is incidental.
Or that there's a lack of structure to it.
Yeah, and I don't think that's the case.
I think one of the issues, though, that sort of presents itself almost immediately is whether you look at P.T. Anderson's work prior to Punch Drunk Love or his work after, this is probably his one film where I say it has the lowest sense of stakes. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Like, not every movie has to be wrapped up in that Christopher Nolan sense of, like, grandioseness, where it's like, if we make a movie about big issues and, you know, put a lot of money into marketing, then we can convince people that this is a film with a powerful message. Go see it. And I don't think, I never get that sense about this film, which is particularly weird when you think about Magnolia as like a Grecian ode almost, and it feels like very classically structured and borrowing elements from like ancient Greek theater and things like this. And this, it's shooting for something else. And I'm almost tempted to say that this is kind of like within that wave of early 2000s quirky movies, like anything written by Diablo Cody. But because this film definitely is eccentric, I would say. Because quirky, that implies like a sort of off-the-cuff aloofness or, you know, a bit of a silliness here. It's like, this film is odd, but, you know, Adam Sandler tries to repair a harmonium that he finds in the street all by his lonesome, and he tears apart a bathroom when he's stressed. He doesn't have a hamburger telephone or speak in, like, weird jive with Rain Wilson. So, like, even when you place this film in sort of, like, what were romantic, dramatic movies of the period doing, like, it still seems to stand on its own outside of that.
Well, I think probably a good way to really start getting into the minutiae of it is to take a look at basically who the character of Barry is that Sandler is playing and the context he comes out of. Because the thing with Adam Sandler's characters prior to this, for the most part, is that they are in some way what I think we would describe as man-children. They are, you know, sort of bro-ish. They are very much sort of frat housey in their approach, which makes sense when you consider that Sandler, when he's sort of hitting his stride, is a dude in his 20s, you know, appealing to the teenagers and the college students at that time.
Well, yeah. And within that, all the narratives hinge around, like, learning some personal responsibility.
Exactly. And the thing about it is, you know, he is this, but there's always that sense that, you know, his rage and his immaturity comes from the fact that, yeah, he is a young guy, and because they take place in these sort of cartoonish worlds, I mean, you know, he learns lessons, however simplistic they are, but, you know, it's always, you know, because we always cheer him on and find him humorous, because there's usually an object that he's been placed against that is usually represented as a complete jerk, like, for lack of a better word. There's always the stuffy upper crust individual that's like the threat, where, you know, dad's gonna give his company to this, you know Yale graduate here who's preppy and nerdy and, you know looks down upon me. Or it's Shooter McGavin, the
greatest villain in all of cinema.
who is just like the most, you know, snobs against the slobs, and then reducing the intelligence of the snobs in this instance quite substantially. I mean, you know, it's easy to root for him and to kind of overlook his flaws to a degree, because everything's sort of set up to enable us to like Sandler's characters in those films. However, in the case of this movie, you know, Barry is, while he has many of the touchstones, exists in a very different context. As in, not just because number one, A, this takes place much closer to the real world than it does anywhere else. Not quite reality, but there is a sense that when bad stuff happens, there is consequences to it. And you know, everybody's dealing with at least very real psychology, which is kind of key to dealing with Barry, because unlike the cartoonish rage monsters that Sandler plays in his typical fare prior to this, Barry is a character that has legitimate psychological issues. Yeah. Some of which we can really pin down to at least some of their origins, but others where I don't want to risk being armchair psychologist, because that's, you know, deeply problematic and, you know, is something I can't do because I'm not actually trained in psychology, so I'm not going to make any
diagnoses. Call out movies when they try to do the same thing, so then we'll have to review our own episodes and call ourselves out for that. But yeah, like, from the very beginning of the film, Barry is in his warehouse, and, you know, it's a plain gray space. The camera work is very just, it moves along like lateral planes, and it's largely still. And in fact, like, the only really remarkable thing about the whole setting is that deep blue suit that Barry wears almost every shot of the film. And, yeah. You know, right away we get this codified as this is sort of like a simple, banal, almost colorless space. And he's the one element that's like, he's trying to introduce like this one element to make it different. And he even tells his coworker Lance, played by Luis Guzman, again, an actor with great comic chops who isn't meant to be funny in this movie. But he says that, you know, he just wanted to wear something a little different, make it feel more like an office. But like in his attempt to do so, all it does is it visually others him against the environment. But yeah. He goes outside, and then, you know, speaking to your point, like, our first sense that this is like our reality, but not quite, he goes outside, and then he proceeds to see a compact flip over, roll on its side a few times, open his door, and somebody drops out a busted harmonium.
Which I like to note, like, we never get that explained, and it feels like in the background of this film, there's a completely different movie going on somewhere else, that this is like us just happens to be interrupting this one for 2 seconds before taking off and going on elsewhere.
And it's almost like this element that in almost like a fairy tale sense, like here literally plunked down in his life is like that disruptive, near magical thing that launches the narrative.
Yeah. And from this point forward, Barry, what ends up happening is a individual who we come to discover is Lena rolls up in a car, parks outside because she needs to take him to the shop, which is located right beside Barry in the next warehouse over, but they're not open yet, and leaves the keys with him, which he promises to take in. Shortly after this, Barry, in a moment that maybe isn't entirely clear, at least as to what he's doing literally, rushes out, grabs the harmonium, and drags it into his office, where he proceeds to sort of repair it to a degree.
And sort of figure out how it works. And I mean, throughout the film, everybody keeps asking him about the piano. And again, like, one of those small details that indicates that Barry's just, his interests lie elsewhere with other people. Every single time somebody calls it a piano, and he just, like, very reservedly is, actually, it's a harmonium. Until Lena, she's the only person that recognizes it for what it is. But I feel like, you know, that's almost too pat a metaphor given the rest of what happens in this film. Like, this is not a film that can be simply reduced to, oh, well, they're in love because they're the only ones who see the world this way.
Yeah, what we do very quickly find out, though, about Barry is a couple things over the course of the next few scenes, which is, one, he is somebody who has a fairly large extended family as far as his siblings go.
Like 8 sisters?
There's 7 sisters, yeah, and then they have all his brothers-in-law and that as well. And what we really quickly is very quickly and firmly established is that the environment Barry grew up in, without going into excessive detail, I think is safely described as toxic.
Yes.
In so many ways.
But the film illustrates that pretty expertly. Like, we don't have to get, like, horrible flashbacks to his upbringing. Even just the dinner party scene. He goes to have dinner with his siblings, and from the outset, like, he walks in and they're reminiscing about their childhood, and they then get on the subject of this one time that Barry got so upset that he ended up smashing some windows. And they basically, it's a difficult scene to watch, because I think there's something very relatable in all of that, where to all of his siblings, they're like, oh yeah, remember that derisive nickname that we used to call Barry? And then they turn and they're like, hey, you remember that, don't you? Don't you remember that? And it becomes, you realize to them, it's just, it's nostalgia. But you realize that to Barry, like, it's aggressive, it's interrogative, and it's something that still is actively very hurtful. And so, like, and while they're all speaking to each other and Barry's off screen, suddenly we cut to Barry proceeding to kick in all the plate glass windows.
Yeah, and the thing that becomes really clear is the fact that, yeah, you're right, this family, it's not just that it's nostalgia, but it's that, I'm sure everybody has those relatives where they think anything, whenever they are doing something that is harmful or nasty, to them it's just funny. They're getting humor, and they don't understand why it is that you're getting upset about it, you know. And
like, we get the sense that Barry has spent almost all of his life being told to lighten up and not take things too seriously.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, suddenly, of course, when he has this freakout moment, I mean, it's interesting in two ways. Because, again, in an Adam Sandler film, the idea of him going around and smashing something wouldn't normally take us by surprise, but what becomes very clear is that Barry has anger management issues, and no, that's not a reference to the film Anger Management.
Oh, you beat me to it.
In there. I'm just heading it off right now. But yeah, he seems to have problems. But what I think is interesting is the follow-up scene is that Barry then decides to take his brother-in-law aside, who, if I'm not mistaken, is played by Robert Smigel,
yes,
comic The Triumph Insult Dog. And, you know, he has this actually rather heartbreaking moment where he tries to do something that is, I think anybody looking at the scene would say, is the healthy thing to do. He acknowledges that he has issues which, again, we're not going to diagnose, but he seems to have, you know, issues with, in it, without, you know, calling it that, I would say almost depression level issues or some degree of that.
He talks about feelings of intense isolation and that he frequently cries by himself. And he basically asks his brother-in-law for help. And this scene, though, I think highlights not only what we later discover sort of the further toxicity of the family dynamic, but this moment also signals just the peculiarity of this film. Because I can see one version of this film where we have the scene, and then his brother-in-law says, but Barry, I'm a dentist. What do you want me to do? I can see that being the punchline, especially when you have Adam Sandler and Robert Smigel delivering it. I can see that being where it ends, everyone laughs. And we do kind of laugh because it's sort of like, you know, it just seems really incongruous with like the seriousness of the scene. But it also doesn't cut there, because instead Barry just continues to talk and eventually starts crying. And we realize like this is not a laugh scene. You know, so there's this weird destabilizing where I think as the audience, we're not totally sure how we're supposed to react. There are certain sequences where we're definitely cued to have one affectative response, but moments like that, which make up the bulk of the film, it's a lot less clear.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, it's, I think it really is a key scene, narratively, because as we go to later, go on, despite Barry asking his brother-in-law not to tell any of his sisters about this, of course he ends up going and telling him, and it becomes one more thing for them to start, you know, shaming him and derisively, you know, intruding into his life about. And this is some of the most painful stuff to watch in the film there, because the thing about it is the toxicity of this family is very authentic, because it's not a clear cut, they're all jerks and he just needs to cut them out of their life. In some instances, they think they're helping him. And that's what makes it all the more insidious, is that they seem to be under the impression that this is going to toughen him up, or that this is what he needs. And that's a really... it is uncomfortable how truthful that feels.
But I also feel like in Anderson's treatment of it, though, like, I feel like that's sort of an implicit thing that we're supposed to notice, rather than something that the film kind of does the top-down messaging for. Like, this is something you pick up in experiencing the telling. And, I mean, yeah, he has the one sister, played by Marilyn Rice Cubb, who, as well, notable comic actress, you know, lifelong Mr. Show fan. So again, odd seeing her without any gags to set up. She plays Elizabeth, who, out of all the sisters, is like the only one that's developed into anything kind of resembling a character. And, yeah, we definitely see that push-pull dynamic at play. Because, you know, there are scenes where she shows up to Barry's office and basically, right before the party, announces, "My coworker Lena, I want to bring her along, and I want to set the two of you up." Which, presumably, kind of a nice gesture. But then she basically ends up interrogating Barry as he's visibly uncomfortable with the idea. It then turns into, "Well, why don't you want to? Why don't you?" And then, like, he can't even respond before there's another question underneath. And that plays out later in the scene where her and Lena both go and visit Barry at the warehouse, where it's just like this constant staccato barrage of questions. And like Barry being so reserved, like, you see that, like, he just wants to lash out, but he just internalizes everything. It's very uncomfortable, and it is like, It's a performance that requires a lot of people working on the same page in tandem. And I think, like, those scenes are uncomfortable and they are not pleasant, but I think they are performed very well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's uncomfortable, but it's, I mean, they're supposed to be uncomfortable. This is not a complaint against the film. This is the film achieving exactly what it sets out to do, to a degree that, yeah, it's going to leave some audiences very uncomfortable and not necessarily wanting to carry on watching the rest of it, per se, because of just how uncomfortable it is.
Well, yeah. And sort of in response to the stress of the party, though, we get another scene that presumably would be, like, in any other Adam Sandler film, this would be to set up a gag, where Barry goes home, and after cutting his coupons, which end up becoming an operative part of the plot, he ends up calling a phone sex line. And the way this scene plays out is very interesting, because it's a lot of long takes as we watch Barry just, you know, stand and pace around his apartment. And even over the telephone, he just gives that sense of, like, palpable discomfort.
Yeah.
And it almost does become comedic when the operator is basically, like, trying to be sultry and alluring and keeps asking, like, "So, are you undressed yet?" And he just very, like, aw shucks, no, I'm just standing here. And, like, he doesn't know how to respond to any kind of social cues, but at the same time, like, the moment that we hear the operator be like, "And what's your social security number?" Like, that's the moment of dramatic irony, where Barry's too naive to understand what's going on, but the audience knows well before he does, and the rest of the scene, there's just that lingering sense of doom.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the thing that's interesting is this sort of speaks to what may or may not be, I think, part of the sort of larger framework of what Anderson's going after. Because the thing about this scene, and the way in which the early half of the film plays out, is the idea of Barry is buried under expectations. You know, his sisters, you know, believe that, you know, all he does is sit in his house all day. So they got to get him out there. They got to get him dating. They got to do something else. And Barry certainly wants that. But it's certainly not happening on his terms, as it were, and it's happening in a way that makes him comfortable. But the thing is, we know that he is in some form something, he needs help in some way. He is somebody who's desperate for connections. And I think it's very interesting in which this film is pretty much, you know, what we end up seeing with the sort of phone sex scene is, I mean, number one, what does Barry actually want out of the scene? Well, he just wants to connect to somebody. Anybody.
Yeah, it seems like he's really calling and paying $2.99 per minute. It seems like he's only doing that because he wants someone to talk to. Like, by the end of the scene, like, it becomes much more sexualized, and, like, Barry sort of agrees to it, but it's with this sense of, like, resignation almost, like, okay, well, I guess we ought to then. And it seems like he's really just calling because he needs a person to speak with.
And the thing about it is, as the film goes on in terms of what ends up coming out of this plot point, because what ends up happening from here is before he meets up with Lena again and discovers who she is and that she wants to date him, this scene takes place before that. What we end up discovering is basically they are trying to extort Barry on this point, which if you can automatically assume, once the Social Security question comes up. But yeah, they basically
Of a tell, all you would-be con artists in the audience.
But yeah, it ends up becoming a situation where they are pretty much threatening and shaking down Barry to get money out of him and make him pay. And his attempts to sort of dig his way out of it by, you know, doing things like canceling his credit card come back to bite him. But I think it's interesting that there seems to be this idea of the way in which, you know, the predatory nature of our culture when it comes to people being lonely in that. The fact that, yeah, you can exploit those who are, you know, sad and in need of a connection into paying to, you know, have anything. You know, doesn't matter how meaningless or minuscule it is. You know, you're going to play off of people's desperation. And in the case, I think it was Barry, as we go forward, you know, whatever his psychological state may be. And then all of a sudden it turns around, you start blaming them for all their problems. That because eventually, you know, people behind this scam and shakedown of Barry, you know, the attitude is, well, he's a pervert. It's okay, whatever the heck we're doing to him, because he deserves this.
Well, it's also that weird kind of, like, justification amongst marginalized people, because this whole scam presumably is run by Dean, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, who we're not given much of a sense of who this guy is. We just know that he runs a mattress store. And that, you know, he seems to have all these low-life criminals at his beck and call. And again, like, that, I think, is another signal, where it's not that innocent man gets roped up in a masterful criminal conspiracy. Like, it feels much more like the Coen brothers, where it's just inept and sad people being taken advantage of by equally inept and sad people.
Absolutely. And, yeah, I mean, it ends up giving this, you know, yeah, no, the world of this film is pretty bleak and downward and cynical in many ways. And the thing about it is, in a typical romantic comedy, if we're talking about that, you know, when Barry meets Lena and they start to connect and everything starts going forward, this would be a big emotional uplifting. That, yes, there is some sense of positivity that, you know, good things can happen. You know, you can find true love, etc., etc. You know the cliches, folks. I think what's interesting about what Anderson does in this film, though, is that, and again, this is where I really start becoming questioning as to the degree of what this was in, whether this was intended or is just a byproduct of his view of the world and the sensibilities he brings to his films, is the fact that watching the relationship between Barry and Lena, particularly from Barry's point of view, knowing everything about him in the grand context of things, it becomes harder to look at this as the love story of two people finding each other in the darkness as it is the story of a man so desperate to connect that he suddenly heads headfirst into the first relationship that isn't abusive, that isn't toxic, and starts clinging to it, you know, in a way that I think in many ways is also very disturbing as it goes forward.
I mean, in 2018, like, it's an easy laugh to write a listicle about, you know, like, Cracked every now and then. It's like, 7 classic rom-com activities that would totally have you arrested. Or, like, you know, whenever people are like, you can't run through airport security anymore. But, like, not in that sense. Like, here's where I feel the film is a little less self-aware, or if it's still being self-aware, I'm not sure to what end. Because, you know, nominally, like, a film about acceptance and learning that we should love the people who accept us for our faults, you know, that is an uplifting message. But I think because we're sort of kept at bay from a lot of Barry's interiority, and what we see isn't very pleasant. So I think, you know, even 15 years removed from this film coming out, like, the idea that Barry doesn't really grow or develop through the movie as much as he finds a way to steer his violent impulses towards noble purposes. So I think there's something unsettling and I think even a little dangerous about a film if we're supposed to take the message as, well, love means accepting somebody unconditionally, or when somebody loves you, you can be exactly who you are. And I think what gets lost in that is there's a lot about Barry that I don't think he should be and probably doesn't want to be. So, you know, like, I feel, because, I mean, as we've also talked about, you and I previously, maybe not in the last half hour, but Lena and Barry's relationship is not terribly developed. And I think the idea is that they don't necessarily even need to know each other or relate to one another, because there's something about love, especially in the movies, that's instantly affectative. Like, it's just, it's that one look and you know. And I feel, though, because what we do see of Barry is very real and very grounded and comes from very dark places, I don't know if those two ideas gel with one another.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, let's take Barry and Lena's first date, for example, because it goes, you know, sort of at first typically how you would sort of, you know, in what I feels like an authentic first date situation with them just sort of chit-chatting about various things and about each other's lives and their sort of personal histories. And then it comes to information that Barry's sisters have provided about him to Lena that he's not comfortable talking about, and then things such as questions about the pudding and that he has stored at his workplace, which we haven't even gotten into the pudding side of things yet, but we'll get there. But he has a bucket load of pudding there, and also the fact that, you know, he may or may not be taking a trip to Hawaii, which seems to have just come out of his sheer panic, more than anything else. And
though he got his wish by the time he made 50 first dates.
Boo. But the thing that ends up happening is when he sort of pushed on this, he goes into the men's bathroom and he goes ballistic, smashing his fist into things, breaking glasses, you know, ripping, you know, faucets out. I mean, it's just pure destructiveness.
Yeah, he's lashing out. He basically has regressed into, like, this primal force because he just doesn't know how to deal with anything else.
Well, it's the thing. You get the feeling it's a lot of internalized self-loathing. But what's interesting is he goes out to carry on with his date, then gets called aside by the manager of the restaurant, and who basically pulls him. It's like, did you destroy our men's bathroom? Points out that, I know you did it. Get the hell out. And Barry, in this moment, he keeps denying that he did it, that it wasn't his fault. And the thing about it is, as played by Sandler, it's interesting because I'm not entirely, like, Barry is clearly lying, but there's almost the sense that he's trying to lie to himself as much as he is to Sky, because it's not just a matter of he's trying to get out of it, it's him trying to deny and suppress what he knows he's capable of.
Yeah, and like, there's a sort of disavowal there. And I wonder if that almost is meant to operate the same way as, like, the harmonium and the pudding. Like, he does a lot of peculiar things that are immediately visible and immediately noticeable, and yet the one thing that makes him most uncomfortable is people asking him about it. And I feel like almost in the sense of, like, yes, I do this. No one has a right to pry into my life. But that doesn't, like, he can't square up the fact that, but you're doing things that by design are going to call attention to yourself. The same way that, oh, well, you know, if you destroy a men's room in a fancy restaurant, somebody's going to notice. But, like, he just doubles down on, as you said, like, that like, he finally learns to assert himself while telling a bald-faced and transparent lie.
Well, and this is the thing, and yeah, at this point, I mean, if you're not feeling uncomfortable a bit about Barry, the thing what really is striking is the way that him and Lena leave, their date carries on, but the thing is, it's treated in a very positive light, and ultimately it builds to, in what is, it does read as sort of a sweet moment where Barry takes her back to her apartment, and, you know, as they're sort of go by, there's that sort of goodbye kiss, but, you know, Barry doesn't, you know, he just sort of, you know, it's a peck on the cheek type thing. It's not a, you know, big sweeping romantic kiss.
It's not an embrace. He goes to leave.
Yeah, and as he's about to leave, presumably the front desk of this apartment building, which strikes me as a little odd, because do most apartment buildings have sort of a front foyer desk that, unless it's amongst the super wealthy? I don't know.
Maybe at the buildings that Emily Watson lives in.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've never been to California.
Yeah, but he ends up getting a call, you know, where she points out, it's like, you know, if you had come in to kiss me, I would have kissed you.
Yeah, and she says, I wanted you to do that. And I think that's a very sweet line. And it does lead to what certainly is presented as a very cute moment where he tries to run back upstairs and then he remembers that he doesn't actually remember what apartment she's in.
Yeah, which is, yeah, it's a great sequence. And yeah, but it's odd in the way that the film seems to almost want to forget what we witnessed not even 5 minutes earlier. And then it cuts to, after this moment, it returns to a sequence of Barry then being confronted by the four brothers, the low-life criminals hired by Dean to go and shake Barry down to get five, you know, whatever they can out of him, because they all assume he's rich because he has his own company and is, as they point, diversifying.
Yeah, and again, like, that allows them to frame it as that kind of justification where even to his face, they're like, there, thanks for the money. Now you think about the next time that you say no to a woman who needs it. And, like, well, they almost have this sort of Robin Hood mentality about it.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, this then leads to a very peculiar chase sequence, which almost, like, I'm trying, it's reminiscent of something, and the thing is, I still can't put my finger on the way in which Barry's being chased down and his sort of paranoia where he's never quite seeing them.
Yeah.
But he feels like he's hearing them. Like, there's,
and the way
like
that space is used, I think the audience is meant to be unsure of whether what's happening is real, whether it's as proximate as it seems, or whether all of this is just like a paranoid fever dream.
Yeah. It almost reminds me a bit of Orson Welles' The Trial, but that's, I don't feel that that's what it's intended to evoke. I don't know, like, I really just can't pin it down, but
no, but it's a scene of expressive shadows, low lighting, and what seems to be progressively narrower and narrower alleyways until, like, that scene, for all of its tension, that's one of the few scenes that does end in a comic beat, because as he's running, finally gets back out to the street, the goons drive by and they yell, like, what are you running for? We know where you live. And then he just stops and really thinks about that for a second, and then he just starts walking. And, like, again, though, that signals how odd this film's sensibilities are, because they're basically saying, we know where you live, and we can come and get you at any time. And that actually does register as a laugh, whereas previous moments that seem like punchlines, they do not play out that way.
Yeah, it's really odd, and the way this sort of works out from here is, you know, Barry, the way in which this develops, he ends up getting himself fearing that this is going to happen again, or that he's attracting their attention and needs to get away from the threat of physical harm or anything bad happening to him, and this leads to a, this impulse decision on his part that even after telling Lena that he wasn't really going to Hawaii, he's going to head over there anyway and, you know, take off there as a way to sort of escape his problems and for the weekend, and that everything should be fine when he gets back. And this is, I guess we should probably explain the pudding stuff.
I was going to say, yeah, because honestly, the first scene in the movie is a conversation about pudding. And again, like, again, that's a signal of, you know, this film does quirky things, but it also invests enough into them that they're real. Long story short, this is actually based off a real promotion. And I think it was Healthy Choice.
Yeah.
Where, yeah, so he discovers that the Healthy Choice brand is offering a promo where if you send in, what is it, 10 UPC codes plus the coupon, you get 1,000 frequent flyer miles.
Yeah. And
just like in real life, it doesn't take long for people to realize that 1,000 frequent flyer miles are worth much more than 10 individual things of pudding.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, and particularly when you come back to the idea that Barry never talks about why he has the pudding around, because the thing about it is, everything he does is actually reasonable and understandable. If he actually could talk about it, I think most people would sit there and say, that's actually kind of brilliant. You know, I mean, yeah, you're technically scamming the system, which I guess then feeds back into the notion of the Philip Seymour Hoffman and his crew scamming him in a way, but that's a whole nother.
But we see the difference, though, because in that first conversation, like, the thrust of it is Barry's talking on the phone to somebody from the Healthy Choice Company, and he's like, so are you sure that this is okay? And even when, because one of the moments where, like, sort of cementing him and Lena's relationship is that he finally tells her his plan. And when he's doing so, he says, yeah, it might seem dishonest, but it's a loophole, and for once, I'm going to take advantage of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you're absolutely right. And the thing is, he ends up roping in, I'm trying to remember Guzman's character's name.
Lance.
Yeah, into helping him go pick up a bunch more pudding, because he's going to go and get those, you know, points, you know, or those frequent flyer miles, and then head off to Hawaii, which leads to a confrontation on the phone where suddenly he's freaking out about the fact that there's like a 4 to 8 week waiting window. Sorry, didn't mean to cut you off there.
Well, I mean, I think there's also something to be said for the fact that at one point, I think Lance does ask him, like, what would you do? Because he works out, like, if you spend $3,500 on pudding, you get 1,000,000 air miles. And Lance is like, well, do you want to travel? And he's like, his response is along the lines of, well, air miles are basically a currency, so why not collect them?
Yeah.
And it's just like that sense of, like, I'm doing this for myself, and I'm not even concerned with whether or not I benefit. But, like, this is the one thing prior to Lena in Barry's life that he has chosen to do, not just agreed to do, not just got coerced into doing. This is his choice. And I don't think it's entirely accidental. What's the name of the pudding, Dave?
It was Healthy Choice, what was it?
Healthy Choice.
Yeah.
And I think in the context of this film's narrative, and knowing P.T. Anderson as a filmmaker, I don't think that's coincidental.
True, that, okay, you know what, that had not even occurred to me thinking through, because it just struck me as such an oddly specific thing, and it's like, well, it can't be that, but yeah, no, that's true, but...
I mean, like, the film certainly doesn't frame it where at the end, like, they finally kiss, and he opens up pudding, and then the Healthy Choice label, like, zooms in on the camera or anything like that.
Oh, that would have been amazing if that has been the choice. Just goes pure product placement. Oh.
Well, exactly. I'm okay with the final shot we get here.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so he ends up, like, all of these sort of, these threads kind of dovetail, where Lena, again, we don't really get a sense of what she does, but we know she has to travel a lot for work, and suddenly the idea of having a ton of air miles, there's a practical need, and he becomes extra motivated to do it.
Yeah, and the thing is, yeah, when he can't quite get his air miles, he decides to say, forget it, I'm just still going to go to Hawaii. Takes off, you know, in a plane for the first time ever in his life, heads down to Hawaii, and again, in a sort of mainstream traditional romantic comedy, there, even Adam Sandler would star, and it would be something like the ending of The Wedding Singer, where, you know, suddenly, you know, he's on a first class ticket and there's Billy Idol and all sorts of crazy shenanigans, you know, and everything comes together and who knows what goes. Heck, maybe even, you know, the pudding company says, well, this is a great story. We're going to advertise your love affair and give you all the frequent flyer miles you want. Who knows? That's not what happens here. He gets here on impulse, doesn't have a hotel, doesn't have anything, goes to a payphone, back when those things, yes, still existed in 2002, folks. Pay attention, kids. The world is changing. But he calls his sister to try and get Lena's number from her. And man, oh man, how do I even begin to describe what happened?
It's a very conflicting series of affects we're prompted to feel, because on the one hand, Elizabeth responds like she always does, whereas, where are you? Why do you want her number? Tell me why you want her number.
Do you like
why
her?
Why do you want to know where she is?
Do you like her?
Yeah. And like, she's just browbeating him, and then Barry has that moment where he stands up for himself, but he does so in a way that there is so much venom and anger in his voice. He basically threatens to murder his sister and then ends by yelling, "Is that what you want?" Which, if you take that dialogue and you place it in any other context, you realize how deeply uncomfortable it is. And it's not clear whether we're supposed to read this scene as, yeesh, Barry, dial it back a bit, or that was unexpected, or if we're supposed to read this as, yes, he's finally being assertive.
Well, this is the problem, because if it's him being assertive, you know, yeah, he's taking it two steps too far, but, and I mean, certainly, yeah, his relationship with his sisters is toxic, but it's never led to the level of, and we're threatening to murder each other now, which he's taken it to. But what's even more unsettling is he's doing this to demand a woman's number so he can go and contact her. And, you know, so there's the disturbing coerciveness of what he does to his sister. But then there's the fact that this then leads to, as you noted, Andrew, a scene where there's the loving embrace with Lena. But again, in context now, what is, in any other movie, would be a beautiful, romantic, life-affirming shot, is now has this undercurrent of, when is this going to curdle? When is this going to come back and bite it? Because, and this is why I think it gets really trouble for me, is that, are we expected to believe that Barry will never freak out against her? And that is something I have a lot of trouble with when it comes to this film.
I think the way that the narrative develops from there, it strongly indicates that, like, she's the one who's tamed the hurricane. But, I mean, that's a very grounded and, I think, valid criticism of this film. And, like, trying to mix, like, the reality of mental illness and trauma and violent outbursts against, like, the fluffiness of cinematic love. And, like, I think the film tries to sort of make it okay, because as we learn, like, the whole reason Lena came to the garage in the first place was that she just saw a picture of Barry and thought that he looked handsome and she wanted to meet him. And, you know, that almost becomes like the sort of the opposite side of Barry and his sort of love at first sight with Lena. The same way that, like, she was hoping that he would kiss her. Like, she signals at every step of the way, like, I want you to do it. But the idea of, like, you know, I'm going to threaten a woman to get somebody else's phone number without their permission, so I can meet them unannounced under duplicitous pretenses, you know, to suddenly be like, well, that's okay because she wants him to do it, that I don't feel is equivalent, and that I don't feel is excusable. I mean, to be fair, Barry does actually acknowledge, no, I didn't come here for business, I came here for you. And the way that scene plays out is weirdly sweet, because I think Sandler is just charming enough that he can make you sort of forget the darker aspects of his character. Like, you want to believe in them having a chance. But it is hard when you sit back and reflect on it to really make such a clean separation.
Well, it's the clean, not only a clean separation. I think the thing is that Anderson at this point, there's some dialogue, because this ultimately leads to an off-screen moment of coitus between the two. We'll put it like that. But the lead into that is there's some peculiar dialogue between Barry and her, where they're sort of talking cute. Yeah,
I feel like it's trying to be a parody of, like, pillow talk and, like, sort of just the odd ways that we discursively express love.
Yeah.
Because she's talking about, like, when I see your face, I want to bite your cheeks. And he responds with, I see your face and I want to smash it into pieces. And she says, I want to eat your face until there's nothing left. And then they both chuckle about, like, oh, that's funny. But, like, again, that signals, like, I feel like the film is paying lip service to the fact that, hey, Lena, she's a bit weird, too. But all the indicators we get of that are not even remotely equivalent to anything that Barry's got going on.
Well, this is the thing. If the film were a case where Lena was developed and we realize she herself has her own severe anger management issues, and that she is prone to similar types of outbursts, you know, it wouldn't make either of them right for what they do, but you would at least get the sense that, you know, Lena at least identifies the same traits in him that are part of her. And you could sit there and say, okay, this is a, you know, messed up situation, but they're both mutually aware of who the other is going into it. And that's not the film we get, because I don't think we ever get the sense that Lena really is aware of just how unsettling, disturbed Barry is. And the thing about Barry is that we know enough about him that I honestly, there's a part of me that feels like Lena is incidental in some ways.
Her function in this movie is to basically be loved and then offer acceptance. And I think, especially, like, I remember even when I saw this in theaters at the age of 16, like, the way this film resolves doesn't quite feel satisfying. Because, again, like, she's willing to accept in the sense that, like, all the violence she sees from Barry is directed for a noble purpose. But, like, when they travel back to California together, and as they're pulling into the driveway, the goons show up, and, well, it turns out that Lena is injured in a car wreck. And Barry's response to that first, like, as if on autopilot, just goes and effortlessly takes out these four guys with that whimsical little twirl of the tire iron as well, which makes the scene, like, this odd mix of, like, gritty physicality and those weird little movie touches. But then he takes her to the hospital, and while he's waiting with her, he gets up, and then he realizes that he can track down Dean. So his response, without even saying a word, he just gets up, leaves, drives down to Arizona or whatever, and has his standoff with Dean. Now, I can see what the film is trying to do here and present Barry as misguided, or the sense that, like, he's so honor bound to protect Lena and, like, never ever see any harm come to her that his instinct takes over, and that it's a more rational thing to, like, get up and just drive without a word if it means keeping her safe than waiting with her at the hospital when she thinks that you're there. And to the film's credit, like, Lena does, in the final sum of things, she does point out, like, that's a crummy thing to do. You can't do that. But, like, even the way that conversation happens, it's just, he says, look, I'm sorry I left you there. I'm sorry. Here's why I did it. And she basically nods and kind of gives him a, well, that's okay. And that is a bit of a problem. And I think that speaks to the fact that, yeah, Lena isn't really developed as a character. She is someone who is there to be loved and to agree.
Well, that's just it. I mean, Barry gets off incredibly easy. I mean, like, I want to say, you know, I want to say that at some point along the line, I once heard somebody bring up Travis Bickle in relation to Barry. I don't know if that's the case or not, but it really is fitting to me in the sense, imagine Taxi Driver, if, you know, at the end, you know, suddenly he's accepted, you know, it's like, oh yeah, we're going to have a relationship and all that. It's like, you did just see everything that transpired previous to this, right?
Well, that is kind of how Taxi Driver ends, but apparently we're also not to take that ending at face value.
Yeah, well, that's... I don't know. That's...
One day we'll have Paul Schrader on the show.
But that's just what I mean. I mean, Taxi Driver's a film that's very much aware. Yeah, Travis Bickle is not a man to be admired or trusted or feels comfortable around. He is unsettling. Barry maybe isn't quite as far gone as Travis is, but it still feels... he still feels dangerous in a way.
And I feel by the end, like, all of his actions are portrayed by the film as noble. I mean, that's not to say the film is presenting him, like, intended to be not problematic, but rather it's just the things he does, especially going into the end, we're supposed to sort of... I feel like we're almost encouraged to give him a pass because he's doing it for the right reasons. And, you know, that is a weird tension. And, I guess the climax of the film is when he confronts Dean in the back of Dean's mattress store while he's getting his hair done. And it's an absurd sequence. And, you know, it's also made more absurd by the phone call they have immediately prior, which is basically them screaming at each other on the telephone and then a long pause and then screaming at each other to shut up. And, like, Philip Seymour Hoffman, I think... sorely missed, underrated as a comic actor in terms of his timing and delivery.
Yeah.
Him and Sandler, like, they... like, Philip Seymour Hoffman is in three scenes in this movie, but he makes all of them work quite well. But they have that final standoff, though, and you have Barry in his royal blue suit, and you have Dean wearing, like, a garbage bag smock with curlers in his hair. And they're basically threatening each other. And Barry has that line, which I think, out of context, I think is a very sweet line, and one that I actually do enjoy, where he talks about, I'm not afraid of you because I love somebody, and that means I have more strength than you could ever possibly realize. And, like, he looks him in the eye, and Dean basically stands down as he says, that's that. And that pretty much resolves it, because he realizes no matter how many times we come at Barry, like, we can't break him. And in saying things like that, though, that definitely, like, that guides the audience to be like, well, I guess Barry isn't all bad. Look at him. Deep down, he's just a big violent sweetheart.
But, and that's the thing about, because there are a couple things about this in the sense that what Barry does is very much in keeping with what his character does, but again, what would the rational thing to be here to do? It would probably be to contact the cops, let them know, these are the people I've dealt with, I've been threatened, they've hurt us, you know, and, you know, take responsibility for the fact that, in part, this is caused by his naivete, even as much as he is a victim. But then also to go along with the, you know, fact that these, you know, let the authorities deal with this responsibly.
But Barry is also a man who has spent, from what we gather, he has spent his entire life being shamed about every personal detail of his life. And people only want to get information so they can exploit that. So I can see why, I mean, when you're being blackmailed by a phone sex operator, that, at least in Barry's case, his first instinct isn't go to the police. Because why would they be any different? Like, when your family can't even be trusted to maintain your privacy and keep your secrets, then why are you suddenly going to walk into a police station and be like, by the way, I called a phone sex line, and this is what happened.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's also the thing where I think that's dangerously close to allowing Barry an out for what I think is clearly disturbed behavior. Because the thing about it is, the way in which Anderson sort of stages this, you know, Barry leaves the hospital, goes to his office, calls Hoffman's Dean, gets into the shouting match with him, And then he goes to Utah to confront him. But he doesn't just go to Utah. He takes the phone phone he had in his hand, yes, while talking to Dean, drives all the way to Utah. I have no idea whether he drove or flew a plane, whatever happened. Taking the phone with him. And basically threatens, you know, that more or less that at the very least is going to be a firm beating, if not outright murder. And again, because of the way in which we're meant to sort of, it feels like Anderson wants us to look at this as a big heroic or, you know, moment of achievement on Barry's part. You know, it's trying to sort of sweep that, you know, the disturbing nature of what he's done under the rug. And what
But there's also a play with the idea of, like, the showdown at the climax. Like, this isn't two romantic rivals and one is besting the other. Like, it builds and it builds, and what we end up getting is two men arguing in the back of a mattress store, and they end up resolving it without coming to blows. I mean, I think the prop of the phone is certainly a good sight gag, and I think at the end, as he's walking out, he finally puts it down, and maybe a little heavy-handed, but, like, symbolically, he's finally hanging up. Like, that issue is done. But it's a nice little touch. But again, that's also a clear signal that something is not right with Barry.
Well, exactly. And then this leads to, yeah, him rushing back to Lena's apartment after he discovers that she's already been discharged from the hospital. And, you know, admitting everything to her and explaining this, which, okay, fine. He owes her that explanation. And as he's explaining it, the thing is, this leads to a sequence which, again, in your typical romantic comedy, The Wedding Singer, it would be the moment where, you know, he makes this declaration about, you know, this super sweet declaration where, you know, once he all gets all those frequent flyer miles in, he's going to go with her wherever she goes because he never wants to be apart from her ever again. And again, in a typical romantic comedy or romance film, that would be the sort of, you know, sweet statement, you know, the declaration of love that's sort of grandiose and magical and that never really happens in real life because, of course, nobody talks like that, but we go with it anyway. The thing about Barry, though, is that we know how disturbed and kind of attached he is. That when he says, I'm going to go with you wherever you go, because I never want to be apart from you again, it doesn't read necessarily as romantic so much as that could almost be taken in a very threatening way.
But I think the choice of language he uses, though, he frames a lot of it almost like it. See, I take that scene almost more like he's asking for her permission. He's saying what he wants, but it's like, instead of the classic, like, masculine speech of, like, you know, I want you to be my wife. You and I will share this life together. Instead, like, the way Barry talks about it, I almost get the sense of more where it's like, please, can I come with you? I need you. Please say yes. And I mean, there is that sort of, like, slavishness that isn't exactly healthy, whether or not you want to read it in, like, stalker terms or not. But there is that sense of need. And, like, even going back to, like, the pillow talk scene, the question is, is P.T. Anderson trying to make a statement with that and sort of, like, make us think about the ways that romance actually has this undercurrent of violence or this undercurrent of dependency within that? I don't know, because that Anderson is a very constructive filmmaker, and he strikes me as someone with a great attention to detail, and this is the aspect that's hardest to figure out in the film. Are we meant to read things as, like, sweet or superficial, or are we supposed to be made uncomfortable by things? Like, is the fact that we walk out of this movie feeling a bit unresolved, is that deliberate?
Well, and I think this, to sort of bring this up, because I there's a word there that you used, I think that's really interesting, which is this idea of need. And it here's the thing, because that is such a big part of this movie, particularly when it starts using He Needs Me from the Popeye soundtrack. During the yes. romantic sequence with Shelley Duvall talking about, he needs me, he needs me, he needs me. And it's something that always crops up in so many romantic films, this idea of, I need you, or do you need me, or everything's built upon need, need, need. I'm actually going to throw this out here. This is going probably well outside the realm of the scope of our show and into larger cultural conversations we're never going to solve on this program. But I think it's worth bringing up. Is the entire idea of a relationship based on need healthy and a reasonable expectation for in terms of love? Because it's one of these things that so much of our culture seems to be built around this idea of you need somebody or somebody needs you. And it strikes me as kind that there's something potentially unhealthy about that line of thinking in and of itself in the grand scheme of things, and not just limited to Barry.
You're not wrong, Dave. I think maybe we should revisit this conversation if we ever get to watch The Lobster for this podcast.
Okay.
But I would say, like, even just within the context of this film, though, I mean, yeah, like, there is that language of need and sort of the leitmotif of he needs me, but that kind of begs the question of what does Barry need Lena for? And it's like, he needs her because he loves her, but why does he love her? Well, because she accepts him. But, like, is that enough? And I don't think that's necessarily a healthy thing. And I find it hard to square up, like, these elements, which seem very consciously, like, placed in the film and encourage us to have these kind of discussions. It's hard for me to reconcile that with the final shot, which is, you know, even though Barry said that, like, he's learning to play the harmonium and he's not going to be doing concerts anytime soon, he's sitting and playing on it, and then Lena comes from behind, puts her arms around him and says, okay, here we go. And, like, it's a really sweet and understated final shot, but again, that doesn't quite gel with the fact that their scene of dialogue where they come together, it does leave that hanging thread of, are we supposed to feel good about this?
Well, and this is the thing, and I mean, to take it back to even an earlier conversation we had when we talked about that film that we wish we could forget, The VIPs. You know, again, when you come back to this notion of need, there's a film where what's the big resolution of that movie? You know, Elizabeth Taylor deciding that she's going to stick with her abusive piece of garbage husband because, guess what? He needs her more, and he won't survive without her. And, you know, that film is completely unselfconscious about why that's super deeply problematic.
Well, I mean, Liz Taylor got to do the same thing in real life, and look how well that worked out for her.
No comment. But the thing about it is, yeah, I mean, when it comes to this film, I can't tell whether, yeah, Anderson is critiquing that notion or whether he is guilty of, you know, indulging in it just as much as this film is.
Because, I mean, for all the sort of throwback trappings, and, I mean, we'll probably only be able to talk about them in hits and pits,
yeah.
There's a lot of things that this film does that really emulates, like, the cinematic language of love. And in that way, it kind of feels like it's sort of an ode to classic romance movies, but there's also that thread of darkness. But I feel like this film, I wouldn't go as far to say that this film is like a piss take of classic Hollywood romance movies or anything quite so structured. But there is this odd push-pull against the way that love is depicted on screen. And I don't know quite what it all adds up to. I think maybe a point of comparison would be Spike Jonze's Her, where, again, we have films centered around lonely, inward, and problematic men and their relationships with women that exist in sort of an abstract space, and it's not necessarily condemning or condoning, it's just presenting.
And that could be the case. Something about this film, it feels like there's maybe more condoning going on, as it were, if only because, in part, again, it's hard to divorce the fact that, you know, Anderson, you know, again, he's, by all accounts, he was, at the very least at the time, a fan of Adam Sandler and his films.
And apparently he wrote the script with Adam Sandler in mind as Barry.
Exactly. So it feels, on one hand, I mean, if he's not in... If Barry is a character that he's, you know, sort of not endorsing or is looking to take apart, it seems... That's such an odd thing to come from what he seems to be describing from a place of at least admiration, if not love, towards this other figure and his work. And on one hand, maybe Anderson, that this was a... Not to say that this is something he would do, I don't think he would, but there's always that sense, maybe this is a long-form ploy played out in the public image where this is the way to get Sandler into a film he wouldn't otherwise necessarily agree to. But that doesn't strike me as what he's actually set out to do. This strikes me as very much, yeah, this is coming from a place of admiration and, you know, in trying into the fact that he invests so much time and soul into what is, you know, ostensibly the Sandler persona, into making a fully rounded character. It strikes me that there is something about this where we are kind of meant to take it at face value. And maybe that's wrong on my part.
I think by the end, we certainly are encouraged to root for Barry. But I think that comes at the cost of also requiring us to forget some of the things that we see in getting to know him.
Yeah.
I think the most frustrating thing about this film is that, as you and I were talking about earlier, this has been a criticism that has been levied at P.T. Anderson before. Films like The Master, I remember. I think it may have been Ebert who pointed out that it's a film with great performances, an amazing soundtrack, incredible set design, a marvelous attention to detail, and yet it feels like there's nothing at the center of it, like that there's something insubstantial about it. And I feel like that statement is more applicable here, because we get that attention to detail. We get some very solid performances. We get an amazing soundtrack and some dazzling cinematography. But it's really hard to pin down, like, what is at the heart of this film? And I honestly don't know.
And I don't have a real good answer myself. I mean, I've got theories, I've got ideas, but I really wouldn't be willing to stand by any of them as sort of a definitive take by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, yeah. And I mean, that's not to say that every film needs to have a clear, deep message. I mean, as we said at the beginning, you know, we can't ever forget that a big part of the movies is going to be entertained and having that fluff. But this is a film that only half of it is fluffy. The other half is a mouthful of concrete. And at the end of the day, it's like, when you put the two together, what do you get? And I think, yeah, I mean, sad to say, after an hour and 20 minutes, you and I are both left here kind of shrugging and saying, we don't know. But aside from the problematics, though, this is a film that I would happily recommend to other people. I think for what it does at the level of form is well worth watching. And I think it's an interesting film. It keeps your interest and it challenges you, whether deliberately or not. And I think at the end of any film, if you still have things to argue about, it's doing something right.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with you on that note. I mean, certainly I'm not going to tell people to avoid this movie. It's worth watching. It's just, I mean, you will be left grappling with things for quite some time afterwards, which is good. I mean, it certainly is a film that will make you think about the subjects it raises. It's just, yeah, you might be left either uncomfortable or confused as to what the film itself thinks it's doing. And well, that's fine.
Maybe the moral is like beauty itself, truly in the eye of the beholder. And with that magnificent segue, Dave, how would you like to take a moment and go with our patent-pending bumper segment, Hits and Pits?
Well, that sounds good to me, Andrew. And since this was your pick this week, what would you say is your first hit?
Oh, wow. This may actually be the one episode where we argue over how many hits are too many. because there are a lot of little elements that I love. I think most immediately evident, though, is the music by John Bryan. I think there's definitely a distinctive sense of a John Bryan score. I Heart Huckabees, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Synecdoche, New York. There's something very organic and something very bittersweet about his soundtracks, and especially using the harmonium as often as it does in the soundtrack here. Like, oh man, it tonally is a perfect match, where it always kind of, the composition scene to scene kind of plays out a little bit differently than you expect it to, but it's always engaging, and it always seems to just perfectly accompany the images on screen. So I feel like if you change anything about the soundtrack, the rest of the film would not work as well, and you can't say that about every film you see. So for that, kudos, John Bryan. You get to be the first hit. What about you, David?
Even though we've been talking about this actor a couple times during this podcast, I would really like to stress how good Emily Watson is with a not really particularly well-developed character, because the thing about it is, and I sort of put this in the notes, it's kind of impossible not to fall in love with Emily Watson whenever she pops up in a film. She doesn't get much to do here, but, you know, there's something that is, how do you put it? There is a warmth there. I will say this. Like, you can buy into why Barry would be immediately struck by her, why he would be infatuated with her, whether in a healthy manner or in a completely disturbed manner. Maybe this is closer to Red Dragon than I would have originally anticipated.
Oh, David, you stole my joke!
Ah, yes.
I was going to say, like, this was a dry run for her making violent men get disarmed by her charms. But yeah, she's very bubbly. And again, she does kind of travel into Manic Pixie Dream Girl territory in a few ways. But you can't really fault her, because Emily Watson is very lovely in this film.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And even scenes like the whole moment when, yeah, she gives Barry way too much forgiveness at the end of this movie and lets him off the hook pretty easy. She comes so close to selling that perfectly. In terms of, like, I mean, if you had another actor there, it would just play as ridiculous. The look on the expression on her face, though, you get the sense that she, you know, knows kind of what's coming and kind of what's happening. And, you know, she's ready not necessarily to strike him down, but at least lay the ground or lay some ground rules there.
Yeah. And the tone of voice that she does it with, it's like the perfect, like, I'm a parent, and it almost feels kind of like a scold there, where it's like, okay, but you can't do that. Are you listening?
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on.
Well, exactly. And while that in and of itself raises even more problematic questions, the quality of her performance is not one of them. So that's my first hit there. But what about you, Andrew? What is your second hit?
My second one, and probably the big one, is the cinematography by Robert Elswit.
Yeah.
Who, well, I guess we'll get into other places he's gone, but he also worked as the cinematographer on every Paul Thomas Anderson film up until There Will Be Blood, I believe. He doesn't have a lot going on in the same sense that Magnolia has a lot going on visually. Boogie Nights has like some of those incredible shots, like the poolside scene that references Soy Cuba, you know. Here, though, even though the material is very understated, he's constantly presenting it in interesting ways, whether it's through the use of color and, like, Sandler in his blue suit up against, like, the gray walls, or just those traveling shots in the supermarket. And I think most impressively is the way that there's that balance between staticity and dynamism, especially when Lena and Elizabeth go and visit Barry at the office. Because all of a sudden, like, without even realizing it's happening, the office goes from, like, a very still, quiet space to suddenly the drums kick in, and there's all this overlapping dialogue, and in the background, the forklift crashes, and then Lance's chair breaks, and everyone's arguing, and the camera is constantly moving, just circling and following. Like, it gives a sense of, like, manic intensity through the visuals. And it's not because, like, there are huge splotches of color flying at you or 3D effects or anything like that. It's just simple mobile cinematography. And it works. And I would totally be remiss if I didn't mention the kiss.
Yeah.
Because we see Sandler approaching the camera, we see Emily Watson approaching the camera, and then as they embrace, we suddenly cut to the image on the poster of them framed laterally as a crowd of silhouetted people walk through, and they just kiss framed in silhouette. I would not be exaggerating if I told you that that's probably one of my three favorite shots in all of cinema. And in that moment, you actually believe in the full, uncompromised sweetness of this relationship. And that is not an easy feat to do, I think we can both say. So kudos, Robert Elswit. You get to be Robert Elswit.
Ba-dum-dum. So I guess for my final hit here, I want to give praise to Mary Lynn Raskob. Raskob. Okay, hopefully, I figured I was mispronouncing it, but you never know. But, no, she gives a really, again, it's a small role in this film, but she makes one hell of an impression, playing what is probably the most sympathetic and human of Barry's sisters, but even then, you know, having this quality where it is so invasive, and so, again, nailing that idea of, you know, being, you know, kind of unlikable, or, you know, it really rubs the audience the wrong way, but you can still recognize that there is something about her that means well, as poorly as she ever achieves it. Yeah, that's not an easy thing to communicate on film, there.
Well, yeah, because especially given, like, the stockness of the other sisters, like, Elizabeth's the one that kind of approaches humanity. And I mean, even that conversation on the phone with Lena in Hawaii, where Lena basically lies for Barry and says, oh, I haven't seen him. She, like, her final line in the film, Elizabeth, doesn't she say something to the effect of, like, well, I kind of hope that you two work out. I think Barry is weird, but he's still a good guy. Or, like, I think he's weird, but that's just what I think. And, like, the way she delivers that, it's like, oh, wow, you actually are a human being after all. And, yeah, it's a bit more complicated than just, like, the evil, oppressive sisters or the one good one. It's, relationships and people are complicated. She plays that role with the appropriate complexity.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, and I think the line is something to the effect where, you know, Lena agrees, you know, Faux agrees and says, yeah, he's pretty weird. And then all and her response is, well, he's not that weird. He is, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's something to that effect. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it is probably the most telling moment where, particularly given the fact that, you know, again, her last conversation with her brother and it involved him threatening to murder her. You know, that's the fact that she's willing to say anything like that is either a writer's fictional invention or something that is we buy into because the actor is just that good. And I'm going to go with the latter part. So, but having said that, Andrew, I guess this does bring us to the other side of the coin, which is Pitts. And I know this one's probably a bit more complicated given the territory where it's not so much necessarily that we dislike elements of this movie as so much as we're just unsure about them. But where would you say is an outright sort of hit or pit, if there is one indeed?
This is going to sound very strange, given some of the problematics we've identified, but I think the only part of the film that really doesn't work for me are the cutaways to, like, these kaleidoscopic color mixtures. As I understand, like, apparently it's some visual artist that does pieces like this, but it doesn't work with the film for me, because it, by dissolving to these beautiful swirls of color, they're pretty to look at, but I feel like that almost gives the film more of a fairy tale gloss than the content that underpins it really kind of deserves. And it's also kind of just formless and abstract. And I think moments like that kind of speak to I guess, the worst tendencies of, like, art house excess. Like, I realize it's silly to be like, I'm totally fine with Paul Thomas Anderson making a 3.5 hour movies about sad people and game shows, but I really have an issue in a 90-minute film where he cuts to 10 seconds of moving colors. But
yeah,
it seems like a wasted gesture or an unclear gesture. And again, with somebody that is as composed and sort of masterful, I'll go there and say that P.T. Anderson is a masterful director, and this is one of the few times he presents a formal element that I can't figure out. I think whatever he's trying to achieve with that, he doesn't. And yeah, I mean, there you can just dissolve to black. It would be fine. I feel like that's in there just as an affectation or a sensibility, and it comes off feeling kind of forced. But that's honestly really the only pit that comes to mind. So, yeah, David, what about you?
The only real pit I'm going to throw out there is not enough Robert Smigel. I enjoyed their one scene together. I would have liked to have seen more of the dentist brother-in-law. But that's also why I'm not a filmmaker and not allowed near an editing room at any point in time. So,
oh, you might get your wish where it's Netflix presents 2019. Robert Smigel is The Dentist, a Happy Madison production.
Well, when you consider that This Is 40 spun off from Knocked Up, I guess anything's possible, so, yeah.
Anything's possible with the power of love.
And, yeah, I think on that note, our discussion of punch-drunk love has sort of come to a close, at least in as much as it's capable of coming to a close.
Yeah, I mean, unless we talk for another 10 minutes and realize that deep down, you and I are who we've been looking for all this time. But speaking of looking for, if you want to look for us on social media, David, where can people find you and scream at you for completely misreading P.T. Anderson's masterpiece?
Well, I was going to say, we seem to be jumping the gun here a little bit, given that we haven't even announced next week's film yet, but...
Oh, right. It's, what can I say? I guess I'm a little punch drunk myself.
There's an order, Andrew.
So I picked this one.
Yeah. So, never mind. My apologies. So.
That is totally okay. David, as the responsible pilot, who is decidedly less punch drunk than I, why don't you tell us where we're going to next week?
Okay, so at this point, we've just, you know, wrapped up this beautiful, if confounding, look at an art house film bordering on mainstream movie. So I figure Robert Elswit, you know, noted cinematographer, would be fun to follow to an early film he worked on when he was just a sort of a camera operator at ILM. So yes, we're journeying all the way to 1979 for Star Trek The Motion Picture, starring...
I'm so excited for this.
Yes, the Star Trek The Motion Picture starring William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, DeForest Kelly, James Doohan, George Takei, Majel Barrett, Walter Koenig, Nichelle Nichols, and scumbag Stephen Collins. So tune in for that episode next week. This is going to be fun. I've been looking for an excuse to talk some Star Trek on the show. So,
and important qualifier for those who don't know us, I am not a Trekkie, but nothing makes me more excited than being able to talk Star Trek with Dave. So if you don't know anything, that means you'll come into the episode knowing exactly what I know.
Precisely. So, until next week, to answer that question you brought up earlier, Andrew, you can find me on Twitter at 24panels if you want to sort of scream at me or hunt me down. But Andrew, if they want to do that to you rather than to I, where can they do that?
Well, you can find me at Twitter as well, which... honestly, I realize I totally missed an opportunity for a bird suddenly appear joke. You can find me at FilmsTripper. And otherwise, if you're looking to help give some feedback and help us grow our audience, 5-star reviews on iTunes or whatever podcatching service you use are the best way to help get some increased attention, get some new eyes and ears on our show. Also, I mean, I know everybody says this, but we mean it. We really do want to hear from you. If we're doing something right, let us know, and we'll keep doing it. And if we're doing something wrong, let us know, and we'll stop doing it. Deep down, we just want to go where you go, dear listener.
We're lonely. Please contact us. Help us. We need you.
We've
desperate.
Got pudding.
Yes, exactly. Pudding.
All the puddings.
But on that note, Andrew, is there any parting words you'd like to leave our dear listeners with?
Why, yes, there is, David. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Unless flipping your car on the road will do that to you first, so see ya.
At least the harmonium's okay.
Yeah. Bye.